You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. In her new memoir, poet and educator Shonda Buchanan takes us through her family's troubled history and her life growing up in Kalamazoo as a multiracial child, African American, Native American, and European American. It is a story about overcoming violence and the price people pay when they're displaced from their true roots for generation after generation.
Wait. To tell you any of these stories, I have to tell you the first, the very first. Somewhere in Mattawan, Michigan, there is an infant buried on top of a 13-year-old girl's grave. The infant, stillborn, was given a name anyway, but the wind buried the syllables under its cool tongue. The child's sutured eyes and never-kissed lips greeted that 1950s winter sky, the color of heron wings, when her father, my grandfather, opened another hole in the mute earth and laid his second unforgiving child's body to rest in her sister's slender, waiting arms. Finally, someone to hold.
That was Shonda Buchanan reading from her new book, Black Indian. Shonda, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
I want to talk about your Black Indian history, about being what you call red black. And you write, if my mother knew anything about being Indian, the culture and practices of any Indian tribe, she never told me. And you say, nobody used the term American Indian in your family. It was always Indian, and you know that meant our people. What did that mean to you growing up, being Indian?
It meant that we had a history and a heritage connected to the landscape, connected to America, one that we weren't told in our history books growing up. And particularly for my mom and my aunts, those who kind of had that oral history, that oral narrative, they didn't have actual records and they didn't have the names of their tribes due to migration, due to the forced migration out of North Carolina, out of Tennessee, Indiana, just the mistreatment, Kentucky, but the mistreatment that mixed bloods, free people of color, red blacks, anyone who was not visibly white had, you know, those kinds of, you know, ostracizations in their lives and their lifestyle. So as people migrated from towns that didn't want them or cities or states that didn't want them, they lost heritage, they lost language, they lost culture. We, lost connections to our tribes. And I think that, again, looking at that migration piece, the five civilized tribes who were forced on the Trail of Tears during Manifest Destiny, the culmination of the experiences of people of color in our country became a thing that my family enacted, you know, kind of in our, in the abuse, in the violence, in the lack of agency, in the lack of self-worth and the self-hatred too that happened, you know, with regards to colorism in my family. And I say, there's a passage where I talk about how my great aunt Catherine, didn't like me because I was the darker Indian, you know, and, from my perspective, I thought I just was a kid in Kalamazoo. And, you know, it was just kind of this thing that you recognize as you get older and older. And then the question that multiracial, biracial, triracial people get, what are you, is this kind of an insidious question that we are wrestling with in our sleep.
When did the family come to Michigan? What brought them to Kalamazoo in West Michigan?
So my mom's people, the Staffords, came to Michigan in 1734, and they were listed as free people of color. It was Jeremiah Stafford Sr., and he brought his entire family from North Carolina, and actually from North Carolina, the trail was Tennessee, Kentucky, Indiana. They owned property in Indiana, and then they came to Michigan, to Kalamazoo, and they owned not just Kalamazoo, but Dowagiac, Cass Corridor, Ypsilanti, I mean, Mattawan, where eventually the last piece of property was for my family on the Stafford side.
Long roots.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my Roberts started actually some of the first free people of color settlements in Indiana. And my predecessor's letters are actually in the Library of Congress, letters that he and his family wrote back and forth to each other throughout the migration period, selling their land in North Carolina and Northampton County and Greenville, and then actually relocating to Indiana. And then my Roberts, Willis Roberts, my great-great-grandfather, came to Michigan, and he saw that fertile land, and it was like, oh, here's a new place to kind of start again, right? And That's what settlers did. But the thing about my family is because we knew we had that American Indian or indigenous or First Peoples connection, we always, to my understanding and my knowledge, respected the people. And even one of my great-great-great uncles left his wife and family, took one of his sons to live with one of the, they called it Tawa, but the Ottawa tribes in the forests, learned healing and medicine from them. They adopted him and his son into the tribe, even though he already had his indigenous blood from North Carolina, and he became Indian doctor. So people would call Jeremiah Stafford, this uncle, they would call him an Indian doctor, and he would help babies be born and, you know, heal the sick. And so, yeah, so it's just such a fascinating, rich history for free people of color in the Midwest.
Yeah, I know you start your memoir with your return from your home in California, coming back to Michigan for the funeral of your Aunt Phyllis. And very, very quickly, we meet your mother, Velma Jean, her surviving sisters, their kids, your siblings, and their kids. And as you put it, my family reunion looks like death. Why was that?
It just always felt so full of tension, even though the love was absolutely there. I mean, definitely there, but it was that hard love. And I always said that my family kind of took on that sensibility of, we love you, but you need to keep up.
Yeah, you called it a trail of tears love. I love that term. Wow.
Yeah. I mean, if anyone looks at the history of the Trail of Tears, you can see, you know, the atrocities that occurred. And this is another thing that we don't see in our history books all the time, right? No one talks about the 4,000 to 6,000 Cherokee who died on the trail. No one talks about the five civilized tribes owning slaves who some they married and some they had children with. And this is how some of the intersections happen between American Indians and African Americans. No one talks about how slaves ran away from plantations to Indian villages who saved them. So the intersections have happened time and time again. So when I look at those kinds of histories, I just think about it and the love of my family and the hard love of my family. I think, yeah, we've been through some things. And the funeral felt indicative of the things that we'd been through, and it just kind of felt like it was manifesting in that moment. And I had always been searching as a writer and as a black woman, as a black Indian woman in America. I've always been searching for the why in my family. Like, why do we love so hard? You know, why do I feel a distrust of men? Why am I so protective of my daughter? And I knew that history had, as I say in the book, history is a lesson with teeth. You know, I knew that there was something in the past that made me ask these questions.
If you just join us, I'm speaking with writer Shonda Buchanan. Her memoir is Black Indian, as we learn about her life growing up in Kalamazoo as a child who is African American, Native American, and European American. And, you know, you talk about your mother knowing, really not ever talking about being Indian or the culture and practices, but by good, you certainly, as you got away from that cycle of violence, the alcohol, the drug abuse that caught up so many in your family. But you then in California, you really began to discover and embrace your true heritage, and you write about your powerful experiences in sweat lodges. You went to powwows, your daughter got her first jingle dress, got your first buckskin dress.
Yeah.
So between all of that that you've discovered and embraced and also the process of writing this really painful memoir, what has that meant to you? How did that affect you?
You know, I have had the chance with this book to recover the secrets of my ancestors' bones. I've had the chance to talk about the women in my family and possibly women in other people's families who have experienced what is a quietest kept secret, you know. And I think it's been a way for me to kind of break that silence that a lot of in my family, for the particular abusers, the people who have abused and hurt the women in my family. And I think it's such an interesting practice in our society that we seem to protect the abuser as opposed to the abused. You know, we seem to protect the person who did the thing as if they will cause some kind of a bad air in the family when, in fact, they are perpetuating just a terrible practice that that a person, a girl, or even if it's a young man, you know, lives with for their entire lives. And I think that's a societal thing as well. And, you know, the whole Me Too movement is, you know, now, you know, people who are breaking their silence. And the Me Too movement is really fascinating for me. And I want to write an essay about this, too, because the people who are coming forth are celebrities and they're stars. And, you know, and you think that Harvey Weinstein, you know, he was so powerful. Why would he do such a thing? But he was powerful and he did that thing. But then what about the domestic workers? What about, you know, the women who don't have a, you know, any kind of a high profile status who have experienced this? And I hear them sometimes when they're checking in, you know, and calling into the radio station and they're saying, they're not saying this, but what they're actually saying is, well, what about me? What about my mom? What about my sisters?
What you're saying in this book, as I talk to you right now, I'm looking at that picture of your mother, Velma, in elementary school, that sweet, happy little face, contrasting that with the woman we meet at the beginning, who is bitter, who has just had this hell of a life. And I'm wondering, has she read your book, and how are things between the two of you today? What did she think of this book?
My mom, I gave her the first manuscript when I first started, when I first finished the first manuscript over 10 years ago. And I continually said, Mommy, make sure you read it. Did you read it? And she's like, yeah, I read it. So, you know, I gave her the manuscript, talked to her, talked to my family, talked to everybody. And I said, I'm writing the good and the bad, guys. So I never hid it. I never said to anyone, I'm about to write only the history of, you know, where we came from as Red Blacks. I said, I'm writing why we are the way we are. It's incredibly hard. And even when I reread this, I am back there. Like, I'm back in every moment, and I'm tearing up, and I'm thinking, oh, this is 20 years worth of being back in that space of abuse, or just, you know, even recollecting it and just feeling like I understand the women in my family so much more.
It's a beautiful journey to see that happen by the end
of the book
where you have. Well, Shonda Buchanan is going to be at Page's Bookshop right there on Grand River in Detroit this coming Friday, the 27th, starting at 6 p.m. She'll be reading from and talking about her memoir, Black Indian. It is free. It is open to everyone. Shonda Buchanan, it has been a pleasure reading your book, pleasure talking with you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you for having me. I truly appreciate it.